Today, have we reached peak housing stupidity yet? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, where I'm the latest post covering finance and property news. Well, the latest home price data to the end of October revealed further median price rises across the board. According to Totality, the pace of growth in Australian home values accelerated in October, rising by 1.1%. That's the fastest monthly gain since June 2023. Momentum has been building in the rate of housing value growth since the first rate cut in February, pushing the annual pace of growth to 6.1% nationally, they say. Monthly gains have been broad-based, with every capital city and rest of state region recording a monthly rise in value, ranging from 1.9% surge in Perth to 0.3% rise in Hobart. Across the combined capitals, the 1.1% gain seen in October equates to an increase of just over $10,000 in the median dwelling value over the month. And since February, capital city dwelling values are up 5.9% or around $53,700. And regional markets also posted solid increases in the monthly rate of growth, with a 1% increase, which is the highest monthly gain across the combined regional markets since March 2022. Regional WA recorded the strongest rise with a 1.8% increase in values, followed by regional Queensland at 1.1% and regional New South Wales up 1%. There are many factors, they say, contributing to stronger housing conditions, but ultimately the uptick in growth is reflective of supply falling well short of demand. At the national level, Totality's rolling quarterly estimate of home sales is tracking 3.1% above the previous five-year average, while advertised supply levels over the 4 weeks to October the 26th were 18% below average. Although auction clearance rates have eased a little, they have held above the decade average in the high 60s to low 70% range since the start of spring. But it is the broad middle and lower quartile of the market where gains have been strongest, they said. Across the combined capitals, dwelling values were up 1.4% across the middle market, but rose 1.2% across the lower quartile, while the upper quartile values were just 0.7% higher through the month. The upper quartile of the market is showing the lowest rate of growth across almost every capital city, said Totality's research director Tim Lawless. Stronger housing demand at the lower price points is likely a combination of serviceability constraints eroding purchasing power, persistently higher than average levels of investor activity, and what is likely a pickup in first home buyers taking advantage of the expanded deposit guarantee. The step up in growth rates does coincide with the expanded 5% deposit guarantee scheme going live on October the 1st, which is going to add to housing demand, especially around the lower to middle price points of the market. Under the Labor's first home guarantee scheme, which came into effect at the beginning of October, virtually all first home buyers can purchase a home with just a 5% deposit without requiring lenders' mortgage insurance, as taxpayers will now guarantee 50% of the mortgage. But bearing in mind, settlement generally takes more than 40 days too soon, I think, to see what the impact of the government scheme will actually be. By the way, modelling by Lateral Economics predicted that the 5% deposit scheme would raise national prices by 3.5 to 6.6% in 2026 and for several years thereafter. However, in segments targeted by first-time buyers, which are defined at those below the scheme's generous price caps, the impact is predicted to be considerably higher, with property prices expected to jump by 5.3 to 9.9%. This, of course, is in stark contrast to the official Treasury modelling, which frankly no one believes, but is proof that the Treasury has become, well, a propaganda arm of the federal government, I think. The Treasury's modelling released ahead of the scheme's introduction forecasts that the policy would only lift home values by 0.5% over a six-year period. And that modelling was used by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Housing Minister Claire O'Neill to shield any criticism that the policy would make housing less affordable by driving up home prices. But as Andrew Bragg revealed in a Senate review, it might be 0.6%, not 0.5%.
like some of those Russian fishing ships that trawl through the Antarctic.
This is not a fishing exercise. There's no Russian boats. It's about modelling for a government program. Shouldn't mislead the Senate.
If that is not the basis upon which this is not being provided, then I'm sure that if there's no other basis of to not provide it, that we will ultimately provide it.
Okay, we look forward to seeing the document.
But you have debauched the processes of the Senate with the approach that you have taken broadly.
5 minutes of the country gave the wrong number on the modelling. He threw a 0.5. The official says 0.6.
It is.
We want to see the piece of paper.
It is.
You can't cover everything.
Absolutely unreasonable.
You can't cover everything up.
Well, the official has said 0.6% over 6 years.
Which is different from what the Prime Minister said.
Confused, you may be. But more importantly, he showed that Treasury modelling was provided, wait for it, after the first home scheme was already announced.
The Minister's Office asks the Treasury for modelling before the policy was announced.
We were asked for modelling in late July 2025.
July of this year. So this was announced in May. And so you asked for your expert advice on price impacts in July?
Yes.
Okay.
Even the RBA has cast doubt on Treasury's modelling, according to the recent released statement on monetary policy. The government's 5% deposit scheme is expected to put some further upward pressure on housing prices in the period ahead, the statement said. The new scheme has no income caps, nor limit on take-up, and maximum property price caps have been increased to $1 million or more in some capital cities and regional centres. It's difficult to quantify the expected effect of the scheme on housing demand, although it is likely to put at least some further upward pressure on housing credit and price growth, the RBA said. And in fact, Michelle Bullock said that this would be positive because it would improve the so-called wealth effect. So effectively, Australia's housing market has become ever more a state-sponsored and supported edifice. The only way the Treasury estimates would become true would be if values were to fall sharply down the track, which would plunge recent first-time buyers into negative equity, while taxpayers would have to shoulder the losses from any mortgage defaults, because it has encouraged first-home buyers to enter the market with low deposits and a guaranteed 15% of the mortgages by the state. Like every previous demand-side policy stimulus implemented over the last 25 years, the 5% deposit scheme will quickly be capitalised into higher prices and larger mortgages, rendering the policy self-defeating from an affordability standpoint. Of course, the play for more supply to solve the housing crisis continues despite progress so far falling well short of the national target for 1.2 million new homes over 5 years. The federal government has promised money to states if they achieve their share of the target and has proposed some other subsidies to boost supply. And now a new report from the Grattan Institute, an independent economic research organisation, but a prominent advocate of the view that more supply is the solution to the housing crisis, is being welcomed by the Supply is the Answer Brigade. Grattan has long been an advocate for the missing middle, demanding higher density housing to be built out around our cities. The latest report argues that there's not enough homes in places that people want to live, making it harder to own a property and pushing young people out of middle suburbs, a problem blamed on an overly restrictive planning system that says no to new housing by default. The think tank says all residential land in capital cities should be rezoned to allow dwellings of up to 3 stories or 6 stories near transport hubs and city centres. Allowing 3-storey unit blocks to be built out over Australian cities and streamline building approvals would save renters an estimated $1,800 a year and shave $100,000 off the median price of a home, but sometime in the future. Australia needs a housing policy revolution, lead author Brendan Coates said. The equation is simple. If we build more homes where most people want to live, housing will be cheaper and our cities will be wealthier, happier, and more vibrant. The result is that Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth and Adelaide are all in the bottom third for density among large cities in the advanced world. And this has particularly affected young people, with Sydney losing 35,000 residents aged 30 to 40 between 2016 and 2021. Very little city land is zoned for buildings of more than three stories. Only 20% of residential land in Sydney, and less in Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth. Even where land is zoned to allow multi-storey building, restrictions on floor space and other planning requirements mean such buildings are not viable in many cases. For example, councils in New South Wales can undermine land zoning for higher density developments by adding requirements that make achieving high density impossible, they said. Councils can dictate maximum heights, limit total floor space and impose setbacks that require large blocks to be left empty. Only one third of Sydney councils actually allow flats to be built on land zoned by the state for those three stories. And they go on to say that when projects proceed to the application stage, they are costly and complicated to produce and take a long time to be processed. For complexes of 20 dwellings or more in Sydney or Melbourne, applicants can take a year or so to get a response. The Victoria and New South Wales governments have recently taken steps to loosen their planning restrictions, together zoning more than 2 million extra homes, but without simplification, the application processes and thicket of rules and regulations, Grattan estimates only a third of those homes are commercially feasible. The report includes a model of the housing market that predicts that the proposed reforms could add an extra 67,000 homes a year over the next decade, with house prices and rents 12% lower by that time than they would otherwise be. These estimates are not merely theoretical. A large body of evidence shows that when planning controls are relaxed, the result is more and cheaper housing, the authors argue. But this is not as reported in so much of the mainstream media. A fall in prices, yeah, maybe, but really, they're talking about just a slower rise, theoretically, at some point in the future. But actually, approvals are not the problem. Delivery is, as illustrated by the Alex Joyner data from IFM Investors. Australia's home building industry is already stretched to capacity, bulging with homes that have been approved for construction but not yet built. And as Karen Kushner has shown recently, the time taken to build dwellings also ballooned out, further emphasising that the construction industry is stretched to the limit. Catalla's head of research, Eliza Owen, recently published a research note examining why government attempts to lift approval times won't stimulate new housing supply. With 2019 homes already under construction and completion times ballooning, the real bottleneck lies in the build phase, not planning reform, Owen wrote. While state and local governments focus on approvals and improving the feasibility of new projects, building companies continue to be stretched thin across an already swollen pipeline and reduce margins. Owen warned that simply increasing approvals will add more new projects to an already swollen pipeline, likening it to turning up the tap on a bath that is already full. And she added that the swollen pipeline has been associated with an irregular increase in time to complete dwellings, an increase in construction costs and other capacity constraints. Effectively, dwellings are being approved but getting stuck in the commencement and construction phase. And Owen also warned that increasing approvals could be inflationary. With completion times already above average and construction costs elevated, it seems an odd time to be incentivising more dwelling approvals and commencements to the backlog of work to be done, she wrote. In fact, without increasing the capacity or productivity within the construction sector to take on this additional work, could even present an upside risk to inflation at a time when the industry is crying out for rates to move lower. Now, the second major problem with Grant's analysis is that it's too expensive to build apartments. As a result, they cannot be delivered at a reasonable cost to buyers, and that won't improve affordability, of course. Urbis highlighted the excess costs of apartment developments, reporting that selling prices in Australia's largest cities rose by a record 24% last year, reaching more than $19,000 per square metre. In the last couple of years, the majority of sales across the country have been above $1 million, targeting that Downsizer Market Urbis director Mark Dawson stated, due to the high cost per square meter, developers have built smaller shoebox apartments. As illustrated by the ABC, three or more bedroom apartments comprise just a modest share of the apartment supply in the major East Coast capitals. The Grand Institute wrongly claims that blanket rezoning of our suburbs for high-rise apartment complexes is the number one solution to the housing affordability crisis. However, high-rise apartments do not improve affordability because they are prohibitively expensive to build. All this conveniently avoids the elephant in the room, migration, which, as you know, is still booming. Not that many in the mainstream media want to acknowledge this as the underlying driver of unaffordable housing, but Alan Kohler is one of the few ABC journalists willing to be open and honest, discussing Australia's immigration system, which is the fundamental driver of the nation's world-beating population growth. Education has a lot to do with housing affordability and the lack of it, Kohler argued recently. Of the 4.5 million migrants who came to Australia over the past 10 years, 1.6 million are students. It's by far the largest component of our immigration program. That increase in student numbers contributed to a doubling of immigration in the mid-2000s, and that in turn contributed to an undersupply of housing for 15 years, Kohler argues. And he also correctly notes that Australia's migration system does not import enough migrants with trade skills, contrary to the post-war migration boom, which saw huge volumes of construction workers from Europe that helped to build Australia. Few of today's migrants from Asia work in the construction trades. No trades are coming in from India and China now to build the houses they need, Kohler added. They're mostly commerce students or cooks. To add further insult to injury, young Australians have been encouraged to study at university instead of pursuing a trade. The result is the construction sector employment has been static for 20 years, even as demand for housing has increased, Kohler argued. Add in the permanent plus humanitarian migrant intake, which was only 86,000 in the year 2000, but in 2025 it had risen to 205,000, and following changes implemented by the Albanese government from 1 July 2023, New Zealand citizens who have lived in Australia for 4 years or more on a special visa category are permitted to apply directly for Australian citizenship by conferral without first becoming a permanent resident. Other nationalities now occupy the places formerly taken by Kiwis, effectively increasing the size of Australia's permanent migrant program by around 30,000 places. The upshot of these policy changes by the Albanese government is that the annual effective permanent migration plus humanitarian program is now around 235,000 places, not to say 205,000, by the way, and it's also around 177 higher than the average level at the turn of the century. Indeed, the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council, in their latest State of the Housing System report released back in May, forecast that if Australia's population grows 15% faster than projected, as it now seems it will on current evidence, then Australia's housing shortage will increase by another 200,000 over 5 years. This 200,000 forecast increase in the housing shortage is on top of the current cumulative shortage of at least 200,000 homes, which was calculated by AMP Chief Economist Shane Oliver. So it is significant that in the past month, there has been a whole procession of opinion polls proving that Australians reject excessive high immigration levels. For example, polling by Macquarie University's Housing and Urban Research Centre shows that two-thirds, 66% of respondents believe that Australia should reduce the rate of immigration to address the housing crisis. Resolve Political Monitor's polling of 1,800 Aussies from across the political spectrum October the 7th and 12th showed that 58% supported a significant reduction in migration levels, outnumbering those opposing immigration cuts 4-1. The Institute of Public Affairs survey of just over 1,000 people between September the 13th and 14th showed that 60% of Australians believe that migration levels are too high, while only 7% thought they were too low. And an extraordinary 71% of respondents also believe that Australia should temporarily pause its intake of new immigrants until more economic and social infrastructure such as schools, roads, hospitals and houses were built. And the recent news poll confirms all of these results, showing that 64% of voters want lower immigration, of which 39% want a lot fewer, versus only 10% who want more immigration. So all up, with the government avoiding the real issue, migration, and gaslighting first-time buyers with their announceables, despite data showing again their approach just lifts prices higher, again, the talk about supply being the answer will continue, even as prices barrel higher as affordability crashes further, especially given the limited space for more rate cuts now due to sticky inflation. So as a result, no, my conclusion is we have not yet reached peak housing stupidity, even if we are well on the way to doing so, which is weird, given the solution is staring the government in the face. As New Zealand and Canada have demonstrated, if you cut migration by magic, you get lower rents and lower home prices. And quickly too. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.